We'd like to call this meeting of the Clark County Commission on Aging to order. Today is Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. You have in front of you our agenda, and we have reviewed it. We have some corrections under new business, updates and announcements. The Clark County Human Services Transportation Plan Community Meeting, which will be here March 20th, was incorrectly transposed for March 16th. So please mark that for March 20th. This is going to be a very important presentation that we're having that the Human Services Transportation folks have been working on. So if you're interested in transportation, this is something not to miss. So with that amendment, do I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Now we have the minutes dated January 16th, 2018. We reviewed those in our work session prior to this meeting. Do we have any corrections?
Nope.
We'll approve them as published then. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we have our representative with the Area Aging Agency on Aging and Disabilities of South Washington, and Pat Janik represents our group, and she will give us a report.
The big thing about working with the Agency on Aging this past week was going up to Olympia for Senior Lobby Day. All the agencies on aging advisory councils go from around the state, plus other groups that have interested in senior issues. Unfortunately, this year with the snow, a lot of people couldn't come, especially from more rural areas. So our group, which usually visits representatives and senators from five counties, we basically only ended up visiting those from Clark and Collitz County because those are the people who could make it. But I still think it's a wonderful, wonderful day. You get to talk with your representatives and your senators, and it's been worthwhile because they really support senior issues and funding for programs like the Family Caregiver Program. And all of this is very important. So it was a wonderful day.
Thank you, Pat. We also have a representative on the Clark County Public Health Advisory Council, and that is Amy Gross. And Amy will give us a report on their work.
I'm new to the Public Health Advisory Council, but did get to speak for a minute or two about that I was the liaison from this commission to their council, and they were very excited about that because there are some issues that we've been looking at the face of the elderly that are public health issues, like the mental health issues and the suicide rate that we looked at last year, and they are interested in coordinating with us in some way about that. And it was interesting, I sat through a presentation about which service dogs can go into restaurants and which can't, and I learned that anybody can get a service dog vest for their animal, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they can be in the category of those that can go into restaurants. So it's interesting information for me to know, and it's interesting for me to bring back to the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. One of the strengths of the commission is that we do have members from all disciplines and walks of life, and it gives us the opportunity to communicate with them and then take communication back for purposes of making recommendations to the county council. So we would encourage, since we are currently going to be losing one of our members who's leaving us because of term limits, we still have applications open for new members, so I would urge people who have an interest and have something that they think needs to be represented on the council to, I mean, the commission, to make that application. You can talk to our staff, or you can go online to the clarkcounty.wa.gov and see the applications there. Being a participant in the community is very important. Okay, today we are very fortunate to have one of the luminaries from Portland here, Alan De La Torre. Dr. De La Torre is an environmental gerontologist and research assistant with Portland State University Institute on Aging. And Alan is our kickoff to frame the discussion for a 2018 focus on transportation. Thank you, Alan. Please.
Good evening. All right, does that work okay? So I'm excited to be back here, and I actually have touted Clark County and the work that the Commission on Aging has done for quite some time. You guys continue to plug away and advance policies and practice here in the region. This is really interesting. I was just talking to Chuck a moment ago about somebody who is working with the Commission, who I hired for a job at Portland State just last week. So I think that the history goes back till maybe around 2007, when there was a report to Metro, the regional government in the Portland region, that looked at age-related housing trends and transportation trends. And we found really quickly thereafter that you guys had taken recommendations and started making changes. And so I like to come up here. I also like to ride C-Tran. It's a very different experience altogether. Unfortunately, the driver of the bus got hit by a car on the way here today, but there were no problems. It only took a five-minute detour. So I want to talk today about transportation, and as an environmental gerontologist, I deal in the realm of many different environments. We could talk about physical environments, social environments, and then also service environments. Today we get a chance to talk about the physical environment and the overlap with services as it pertains to transportation. So even though I'm not a transportation planner or have a background in transportation, this is an area that I work on in my day-to-day job as well. So I'm really excited to be able to talk about this today. I did see on the agenda that it looks like a 5:30 end time, and I'm wondering if that's a gentle nudge to go quicker today. I think it might have been a misprint that 6:30 is the end time today. 6 o'clock, okay. Just making sure that it wasn't an advanced yet that out there. So let me take a quick step back. Transportation and transit they're represented in many different forms. And so today I want to give as big of an overview as I possibly can without jumping too much into any one topic. And I had the opportunity to talk to Marjorie and to Jackie as well in framing today's talk. But I know that you'll get the depth in a lot of these topics as each of the presenters come over the next months, all the way through to February of next year, right? I do want to make a quick plug that on March 7th, from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock at Portland State University, your keynote for February of 2019, Jana Leinert, will be in Portland for a free presentation. So if you're interested in learning more, let me know, and I'll pass that information on. It's co-sponsored by the Institute on Aging, so kind of making a plug for this free event. She'll also have an opportunity to talk a little bit about how to position that February 2019 talk with us. So just really quickly want to call your attention to the image that's on the background. Right up here. And just mention that there are lots of modes that are represented here. I'm not going to talk about the concept of active transportation, but active transportation is kind of all personal vehicle modes of transportation, so walking, transit, bikes. And this represents not only that active transportation realm, but also the vehicles that are there, which are a critically important part of transportation for an aging society. So I'm not here to rail against the vehicle, the automobile. It's actually an integral part of the transportation and mobility systems for people of all ages and abilities. So I'm going to start here by reaching back to some research that we did as part of the original age-friendly project in my work at Portland State. So there was a woman who lived in an apartment complex, and she said, one of the things I do is I give every new person in my building a ticket, tell them to get on the bus and ride the entire route to see what they could do, where they could get off. It's a very convenient bus. This is an interesting concept that we've passed along to municipalities around the world, and it's something that's stuck. How much does a single C-Tran ticket cost? $1.85, something around those lines? The investment of that, let's say $2, to get on and to become familiar with what your transportation route can get you to is invaluable. Not only that, and I'll get a little bit into some of the services and travel training a little bit later, but quite often that first ride is the biggest barrier to using transit and feeling comfortable in those scenarios. So what is good transportation? This was a debate in my household over the last week. I'm not quite sure if I got it completely right. I qualify this by saying my wife is a transportation planner, so she is the expert in the house. So when we talked about this, she said I mostly got it right, although I think that there were some things that she would add. But good transportation connects people to places. Good transportation is efficient, reliable, comfortable, flexible, affordable, safe, and equitable. There are a lot of pieces that make this whole system work or systems work. So I'm going to dig in a little bit more to each to some of these points in particular. I want to frame transportation, age-friendly transportation, transportation for an aging society around the concept of mobility. So this is boiled down in its simplest form. The next slide is going to probably be mobility in its most complicated form. So we'll kind of juxtapose these two things. But mobility is really about the ability to move or to be moved. It could be walking, it could be driving a car, it could be getting on transit. It doesn't mean that you have to do that yourself. It may be an ADA paratransit service or a community transit service that gets you around. But really, it's about moving. The complicated theoretical framework around mobility is a little bit denser. I had to study this. I was outside actually reviewing this slide in particular to try to wrap my head completely around it. But this is the concept of life space or life space mobility. So there are six different components that you can see in the top that are critically important to life space mobility. They would be financial, psychosocial, environmental, physical, cognitive, and then some demographic characteristics such as gender, culture, or biographical influences. And each one of those intersects at different levels of our home and community environments. So at the bottom level here, you've got a room that could be nested inside of a house. So I just want to take these two concepts really quick and think about these other contributing factors. So a room may have a financial component based on the cost of the rent or perhaps the cost that it would take to modify that room to be accessible or to be usable for an individual. You could think about a bathroom, right? A bathroom might need a grab bar or it may need some other system to get you into and out of and to use kind of in a different way. The home, as well, might have a financial component to it or a modification component. What we found in this project that we're working on currently as part of the National Institute for Transportation and Community project is that all of this stuff is interconnected. So an individual's home environment will actually change the way in which they're accessing their community in a number of ways. So the study that we're doing is a 25-person qualitative study to ask how home modifications have changed people's mobility or how it's changed the way that they get out and move around their community. So we're theorizing at this point that a home modification in a bathroom or a bedroom would be less important than a home modification that would allow you to enter or exit your home, such as a ramp or grab bars or rails that would be on the outside of your house. So we'll see how things come together. We're just about to start our data collection, but we are basically interviewing folks who've had a home modification through a community development corporation and are now looking at what their life space mobility would be in their immediate neighborhood, their larger community, and then the region as well. So how do you access things like a grocery store versus your medical services or perhaps another governmental service like a post office or even the building permit place where you might need to get a permit for a heating or air conditioning unit or a change that you may have made to your house. So each of these levels that you see going up from a room to a home to that outdoor part of your environment, your neighborhood, your service community, that surrounding area, and even the world are really determining factors for the way in which we interact or mobility is affected in certain ways. So like I said, that's the most complicated that this presentation is going to get. This is the theoretical construct, and you can test each of these levels with each of the contributing factors as well. So if we wanted to look about neighborhood level, what type of effect would we have if somebody had cognitive impairment? So for instance, what kind of wayfinding or signage might be in the neighborhood to help you get to the bus stop or to get to a service center or even to get to a food or a grocery store? Those things are all important for our mobility, right? Moving around or having somebody move us around. And so I'm not going to dig any deeper on this, but I wanted to give you both kind of sides of the mobility equation. When I boil down mobility for older adults, there are five big pieces that I want to talk about. The first is the auto-based system. The second is pedestrian or multi-use facilities. The third is public transit. The fourth is ADA paratransit services. And the fifth, community transit services. And many times those are similar in what they look like between ADA transit and community transit. This is not a qualified mobility service, although I like the idea as having a couple of kids who like to push me around on different things. It's normally the other way around. My daughter likes to get on my back and pretend like I'm a horse or something along those lines. So let's jump into the auto-based system. So this includes single occupancy vehicles and high occupancy vehicles or shared rides, taxis, the shared economy service, things like Lyft and Uber. So of the 65 and older population, approximately 16% of the population is a licensed driver, which is higher than the proportion of 65 and older people. So approximately 14 to 15% of the United States is age 65 or older, but a higher percentage actually drives their car. And I don't have the statistics on how many people 65 and older are licensed, but I know that it's someplace above 60%. And there are a lot of folks who use private vehicles as the main way of getting around. A couple of things about auto-based systems. So older adults are more vulnerable in motor vehicle crashes due to their fragility, and that is especially important the older an individual gets. So if somebody is aged 80 or 90, they're more likely to be fragile and more likely to see a serious injury in the incident of an accident. However, older drivers, even in their mid to late 80s, have lower crash rates per mile driven than those in their early 20s. And so it's a misconception that older adults are bad drivers. Every cohort, every age cohort has good and bad drivers. And older adults can have correlates to certain disabilities. Around the age of 75, we start to see a correlation between age and disability. I think it's important to note that before that, you can't really say an older person would have a disability as a natural progression of age. So it's around 75 where you can start to see that higher relationship. Then cessation of driving can contribute to a lot of issues, including social isolation, depression, and other health-related issues. This is something that I've experienced in my family. My grandmother, when she finished driving, went through an extended period where she was driving dangerously. And it actually took an intervention for us to say, you know, this is really important. But what it has done as an unintended consequence is that it's put her in a place where she's less able to connect with her family in particular. She still has a social kind of circle within her assisted living facility, but she can't as easily get between her house and my mother's house, which is only 3.5 miles away. So it's changed a lot of the things that we've found with our family. And I'm going to get into, at the end of the presentation, some issues around safety and driving and some suggestions for thinking about having the conversation, the difficult conversation with a family member who may need to stop driving. With respect to pedestrian and multi-use facilities, these include things like sidewalks, trails, bikeways, and multi-use paths. Walking is the second most important travel mode for older people. About 9% of all trips are taken through walking, with automobiles being the top mode of transportation. Among older adults who don't drive, walking accounts for 1 in 4 trips, which is really important. So how are people moving around or being moved when they're not able to drive? Quite often, walking is one of the answers. Its importance increases with age. As people drive less, as they may have less ability to even navigate their own longer distance environments, walking in closer proximity at 1/4 mile in particular is really important, and I'll dig into that 1/4 mile metric a little later. Some of the challenges with pedestrian and multi-use facilities include a lack of sidewalks, and also a system of connected sidewalks. And so sometimes we talk about street connectivity. So you can talk about, say, the distance from here to the river as kind of as the crow flies, right, as a direct path. But if we were to get from here to the river, it wouldn't be a straight shot. We would need to think about the street connectivity in order to get from here to there. A body of water, a ridge, a mountain, streets, fences, parks can all get in the way and cause us to go further to get to a destination. And so street connectivity is something that is really important when thinking about connected communities, safe streets, and complete communities. Other components of challenges include unsafe intersection crossings, cyclists on the sidewalk, or even cyclists in bike paths, which can actually cause some problems for drivers as well as other cyclists. I remember in that 2007 Age Friendly study, we actually had a conversation with this woman who said, "Those darn cyclists are so cavalier in their attitudes that I'm always nervous, whether I'm walking or driving, that I might hit them or they might hit me." And it was that fear of not knowing what the cyclist would do that was problematic for her. Cyclists or obstructed sidewalks are also a big issue. So this is something that I've actually, well, I'll confess, I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon on this issue. So in my neighborhood, I've left several notes on cars that are parked literally on the sidewalk. I don't know what it is, but I think pushing my, you know, one-year-old in a stroller and being forced to go into the street because somebody inconveniently parked on a public right-of-way, which is a sidewalk, leads me to want to write a note saying, "Hey, this is illegal. You should move your car out of a pedestrian right-of-way." I know this is a little much, but for whatever reason, I think that this is one of those issues that goes completely undetected in communities, and there's no enforcement in areas. So that's my moment of curmudgeondom. I'm going to get away from that from now. But a couple other things about challenges include uneven pavements or failure to remove things like leaves, ice, snow. You know, the concept of ice and snow recently hit us, right? So our responsibility is to clear these sidewalks so that people can get through them. Also weeds and roots. I had a few $1,000 bill for having to put new sidewalks in front of my house a couple years ago. I was surprised at how expensive it was. The key is getting a good arborist who knows how to put in trees that are urban trees, right? So people often will put in trees that look nice or they look good when they're small, but what are their root systems like and how do they grow over time? Not in power lines, but definitely not to obstruct sidewalks. Public transit is obviously an important part of the mobility system and transportation system. This would include buses, light rails, heavy rail, aerial trams, and ferries. Yeah, interestingly enough, I don't think that there's a ferry service here in Clark County, nor is there south on the Oregon side. But ferries are things that could actually be considered as a public transportation option. But riding public transit is the older adults' third most frequent mode of transportation behind autos and walking. Research has shown that in order to increase older adults' transit ridership, that service providers need to do a number of things, increasing safety and security in all parts of the system. So not only actual safety and security, but the perception of safety and security that might increase ridership. Providing better information both before and during travel. So the beauty of having all of our smartphones out is that we can kind of find out real-time arrivals and kind of understand exactly when we can plan a trip, when we have to leave our house, and when we show up. Expanding the hours of service and providing additional routes. And I want to say I understand that there are funding constraints associated with this. It's impossible to have, you know, transportation routes, frequent service routes all the time for all people. But there are off-time, non-rush hour kind of services that actually would work well for a number of people, including weekend services. Making service more reliable, and this could be as simple as not having to wait for 15 to 20 minutes for your transit when your app or the phone call that you said it's going to be there in 5 minutes, but knowing reliably when it says 5 minutes, it actually is 5 minutes. And then also enhancing driver training. So as part of the World Health Organization's age-friendly project, I had the luxury of going to London to talk about those original findings in 2006 and 2007. And one of the commonalities we heard across all of the municipalities was that drivers, regardless of whether it was in China, in the United States, or just about any other country, that drivers didn't wait for people to sit down everywhere. Right, this is a concept related to driver training. And so I know some of that is anecdotal, but I think it's really interesting that people had the same complaint about those systems just about everywhere. So enhancing driver training is one thing to understand that older adults, frail individuals, people with disabilities may actually have different needs or need to have slightly different time to sit down or to get situated. With respect to ADA paratransit services, these are services that are disability-based, not age-based. They're demand-responsive and complementary to fixed-route services. So ADA paratransit services are not an on-demand call service for anywhere within the region. So you can't live in an area that doesn't have fixed route and get that same ADA transit service. And I'll show a map a little bit later to show where Clark County's C-VAN operates, and it's not comprehensive of the entire area. Also, ADA requires public transit operators receiving federal financial assistance to provide special demand-responsive services to people with serious disabilities. And this is a qualification question. So what is a serious disability? How do municipalities determine who is eligible for those services or not? So each system is really important for understanding who's in, who's out, and who might be kind of on the fringe in a number of ways. Eligibility for ADA complementary services is based on disability, not age. So it's important to understand, once again, what do you qualify for based on your functional ability? National data show that fewer than 8% of older adults with disabilities ever report using these services, which is really interesting. So it's a low percentage of individuals, but really what a lot of transportation agencies are encouraging is people to ride fixed route transit as much as possible. So based on an article that I found, a December 2016 article in the Columbian, the cost of a fixed route service was $5.99 per ride, whereas the cost of a C-VAN ride was $44.06, and it shows the great cost associated with those ADA paratransit services. And I think what's important to note here is that often community transportation agencies like C-TRAN have a fixed budget. So if you have more ADA transit services that you're providing, the pie doesn't grow. You're actually cutting into other services that may exist there. And I'm not advocating against ADA paratransit services, but just to say that this is a challenge with providing services in the community. So this is the C-VAN service area. You can see the green being C-VAN service, and then the C-TRAN connector service being what would be in this brown. So this is not comprehensive of the region, and I would venture to say that there are areas here that do have, that these areas are where the majority of your fixed route transportation services are. And I'll talk a little bit more about suburban, rural, and remote communities in just a moment, but I think that this is important to note that there are gaps in the service for people who are looking, who have serious disabilities and are looking for particular ADA access. A couple of things about C-TRAN that I learned, which are really exciting, and you probably know this already, but I'm going to mention them anyway. There's a travel training program that's designed to help older adults and people with disabilities learn how to use a fixed route bus system. Riders can meet with a travel trainer to learn how to plan the trip, pay for the trip, read and understand schedules, recognize bus numbers, stops, and landmarks, and transfer to another bus or transit system. And this is really helpful for getting people the confidence to ride transportation systems. My sister, who is planning to move to the region soon, is somebody who actually benefits from something like this. So she doesn't feel comfortable in getting on a transit system. She had a traumatic brain injury when she was 16, and she's now 37. She doesn't feel comfortable in just jumping on a transit system and asking a driver where she should get on or get off. She needs that upfront assistance to get the confidence. She needs experience several times through to get to a place where she could actually ride transit on her own. There's also a travel ambassadors program. It allows riders to give back to the community. This is kind of a volunteer program for C-TRAN. Helps to grow public transportation in the region by assisting with public outreach, community events, and helping others to learn that fixed route bus system. The fifth component of the mobility system is the community transit system. So these are non-governmental, special, demand-responsive paratransit services. So similar to the ADA paratransit, except for they're not connected to the public transit system and they're non-governmental. So this would include things from nonprofit agencies, from faith-based groups, and from advocates for older adults. So these are really important systems to fill the gap, especially where there might not be fixed route services or ADA paratransit services. Most providers do limit their services to a smaller number of clients or affiliated riders, and less than 3% of older adults with disabilities have ever reported using this type of community service, community transit service. That kind of rounds out the five types of transit. or mobility options. I want to talk a little bit more about some important transportation issues to consider. And as a reminder, over the course of the next year, there will be experts coming to fill in the gaps. This is a very kind of high-level overview. And I'll try to answer questions as best as I can, but I just wanted to provide a preview of a lot of the issues that will be on the agenda. So rural and remote communities are incredibly challenging. I'm on a listserv for the Grantmakers of Aging about rural and remote aging in place. And there are serious issues that are hard to overcome, but a couple things that I wanted to touch on. So the demand for rural transit is substantial and it's growing. We know that older adults tend to stay within communities that they live in, and quite often younger people are moving out of rural and remote communities to find jobs, which leaves higher proportions of older adults and higher need for service, transit services often in rural and remote communities. Approximately 40% of all rural residents live in a county that offer no public transit services. So it's relying on those community transit services, neighbors, informal networks, or their automobiles to get around. The scale of transportation challenges presented by the aging population really requires a national response. This is very difficult for local transit agencies to solve. There is some pooling of resources that could kind of occur, and healthcare providers that are also understanding the importance of specialized transportation to and from healthcare settings. I was in a meeting today earlier that they were doing some research with the, as medical transportation options were being provided, they were seeing a decrease in the amount of those services being requested and an increase in the amount of transportation services that were being requested for recreational uses. So as people met their medical needs, they were finding other transportation needs that were becoming priorities, in particular, recreational types of things. So they find maybe their families are very happy to drive them, you know, over to the doctor's appointment or to the grocery store, but are less likely to maybe drive them over to a recreational stop or to do something with them because they're already taking that time to do something. And this is even exacerbated more within rural communities where the distances are further to travel. And then the figure here, here on the right is a brief geographic distribution, a brief kind of look at the geographic distribution of older Americans age 65 and older. So more than half of older Americans are living in suburban locations, and the lower density leads to less transit options. About a little less than a quarter live in a rural community, with about 21% living in an urban area where you'll see more frequent transit services. So the people who are best served are the lowest proportion. And the folks who are having the most difficult time in that rural community are a substantial proportion, in almost a quarter of that population. Hmm. With respect to suburban communities, a study that's a little dated now, about 15 years, found that 79% of older adults age 65 and older live in car-dependent suburban and rural communities. Right? So three-quarters, or more than three-quarters of the population, are living in places where they actually need to be car-dependent. This is particularly problematic for people as they're aging beyond their comfortable or safe ability to drive those vehicles. The population of older Americans is growing in suburban and rural areas because people are aging in their communities or aging in place. And then aging in suburban communities is seen to potentially exacerbate an already problematic mismatch between the future demand of transportation options and existing transportation services. So one of the things I talked about last year when I was here about was the retrofitting of suburban areas. This is a challenge that's in front of a lot of us, but as we see communities continue to grow, as places like Washington and Oregon continue to restrict the type of development that you can have outside of urban areas, we're going to see changes in our suburban communities, which could be good from a transportation provision perspective, because higher densities allow for more transportation options to be offered, or at least it helps in making those things pencil from a transportation provider perspective. One of the things that I didn't mention here as well, and I just have anecdotal kind of information, but the cul-de-sac is actually, it's been considered to be dangerous for some families that are there because there's a lot of reversing and turning around that occurs in that type of street. So I think it's important for folks who are living in cul-de-sacs, and I grew up in a cul-de-sac, to be especially cognizant of the fact that there are pedestrians and other people who are using those streets in ways that are more recreational than you would see a main thoroughfare, right? I knew as a kid that I could go out and play ball in my cul-de-sac because we could see almost all the traffic coming in one direction outside of the other vehicles who would be leaving from our community. So it's just an interesting little side bit about suburban communities. I like the cul-de-sac that I lived in. It was a good place to kind of grow up, but it is important to think about that challenge. A little bit about designing communities. So walkable communities in particular reduce the risk of chronic disease and are shown to improve public health and quality of life. Walking as a form of destination is obviously important, as we saw in the earlier slide, for older adults increasingly as they do get older. And then the concept of universal design. Universal design is an interesting concept in that it's a series of principles that can be used to design communities. So you can talk about low tolerance for error or intuitive use. All of these things are design principles. They're not as easy to implement because they don't have hard and fast design regulations or recommendations. But universal design in general, which is this idea of creating communities that are good for all or all ages and all abilities, can do a number of things that are important. They can be safer, more accessible, attractive, and desirable. They're easily repurposed in a number of ways for the users who'd be using that environment. They're capable of reducing falls and health-related expenses. And there's minimal cost in new construction. So retrofitting a non-accessible community requires a large amount of money to deconstruct or to break something down and then to build new, whereas universal design gives a good baseline for building on top of or to kind of supplement those environments in some way. So I want to talk a little bit about neighborhood features that really are important for playing a role in healthy aging in place. And these next slides are pulled from a Population Reference Bureau report. The actual reference is here on the bottom. But I think that there's some pretty powerful stuff that's here. So if folks wanted to dig deeper into how neighborhoods do impact aging in place or healthy aging in place, take a look at the report. So the first is a walkable community, as we were just talking about. This includes sidewalks and crosswalks, intersections, few dead-end streets or cul-de-sacs. The benefits include lower obesity rates, better self-rated health, or people saying that their health is good for that reason, and lower rates of self-reported disabilities. Accessible environments. This is extensive street-level public transportation, well-maintained streets and sidewalks, and those benefits include more walking and fewer mobility problems among those who have difficulty walking. Compact communities are also helpful for healthy aging in place. They provide a diverse mix of residences and businesses that are in close proximity to people who live there or are taking transit to that location. Potential benefits include less mobility disability, more walking outside for those with disabilities, longer walks by older men. You can see this is a very specific finding from a very specific study about older men in particular, and lower heart disease risk, which could also be a very important part of healthy communities. The next piece is the safe component, or safety. Residents consider their neighborhoods safe, which is helpful for them in that it perhaps contributes to greater likelihood of recovering from mobility limitations. So you may have had a temporary or medical disability that you would recover from, more outdoor physical activity, and more frequent and longer walks in general. Also, resources and services that are built into a community are important, things like parks and libraries, community centers, and public spaces. This is actually shown to contribute to slower cognitive decline in many ways, which is really important in that we have seen the rise in the incidence of Alzheimer's and other dementia or cognitive impairment over the last 20-plus years. And also healthy air can be helped by looking at aging-in-place compact communities. This can improve the air quality and also can improve cognitive function. Jumped way ahead there. So getting back to this concept of proximity to services, there are two important things that I want to note here. So the first is that American Planning Association has really called for communities to create housing options that are affordable, accessible, and close to services. So the metric that's most often used in transportation circles is a half of a mile. A half a mile is about what people would expect individuals to be able to walk to in a comfortable way. We have encouraged highly our local governments and municipal kind of bodies to consider close proximity to services at a quarter mile or 0.25 mile metric. This is backed up by research that actually shows that that's about the proximity that somebody with a mobility impairment may be more comfortable walking. So I gave a couple of references if people wanted to dig a little bit further into that. Walk Score actually uses a quarter of a mile as the metric to be in close proximity to a service as well. And so I encourage folks to think about a quarter of a mile as the metric for proximity to a potential service. I live 4/10 of a mile from the closest transit station to my house, and it works out fine unless I have to carry my kids, or unless I have a large load, or unless it's raining really bad. But the quarter of a mile, which is where my local corner store, I actually can brave that pretty easily. It's for me, easy. When I've got a kid or when it's raining outside, I feel like I can get there a little easier. I want to introduce a concept or a metric that's being used around housing and transportation affordability. So I know this is not a housing presentation, but when we talk about affordable housing, we often talk about whether you can afford the housing and utilities that you live in by paying no more than 30% of your entire paycheck. So that would include people who are receiving little or no money. 30% can be a very small number. But what the Center for Neighborhood Technology has suggested is that we think about housing and transportation as being inextricably linked. So when you make a housing decision and say, okay, I found housing that I'm only paying less than 30% of, but it is in a far-flung area of the community where your transportation costs are growing and growing, or higher than they might be if you were in closer proximity, you've got to combine those costs to understand whether those two things are affordable. So the metric is, or the benchmark is, that no more than 45% of your household income should be used for housing and transportation combined. So I plugged in Clark County, or actually Vancouver, Washington, not Clark County, to find out where the Housing Plus Transportation Index was. And you came in at about 46%, so just over the cutoff. And there are areas within the community that fall under that area and some that fall over that area. And so it's an interesting thing. You could plug in an address to this website. It's a free website that you could go to and learn how that matters for your particular neighborhood or your particular house. So in particular, you could see down here the housing costs plus income. So for Vancouver, housing costs 24% of the income, which made that metric affordable based on that traditional 30% affordability metric. But when you add transportation, it actually knocks you just over that affordability threshold. Now, there are some people who push back and say that this is not the metric that they prefer to use, but it's something that I'm increasingly feeling comfortable with using when talking about affordability. For those of you who are not familiar with Walk Score, I'd suggest taking your address, plugging it in, and seeing what the output looks like. So I plugged in two particular pieces here for walkability. So Esther Short Park in downtown, they came out to be a very walkable neighborhood with a transit score of 57, which shows to be good transit. Then I looked at the downtown Orchards area, the Fisher's Village, which is on the kind of fringe of the community. And that was a very car-dependent neighborhood, and it had minimal transportation options that were available to you. So Walk Score is not the perfect metric, it's not the perfect website, but it's an idea for what is close to you. And I'd suggest if you haven't, plug in the address that you live in, plug in the address where you work at, and try to get an idea of what those scores look like. It'll help inform what you know about the community and what you could access. In addition to Walk Score, AARP's Livability Index is another way to understand how one could be, or what one's livable community kind of metrics are. So this score was a little bit closer. I plugged in the same two metrics in downtown and then that Orchards, kind of Fisher's Landing area. The index for livability in downtown came at a 60. And then you can see the breakdown for each of these areas here. So it's be housing, neighborhood, transportation, environment, health, engagement, and opportunity. You can see that downtown transportation score is very high here. And then over in the other area in Orchards, the score being 52 was kind of right about the middle point for communities across the United States. But that transportation score in particular dropped 20 points, which actually is right in the middle as well in communities across the United States. You can click on each of these, and this is a static slide, but if you wanted to find out more about each of these areas, there are a number of data points that AARP contributes to those metrics. And so you could click on engagement and understand what opportunities there are for volunteering or engagement. But those transportation pieces in particular are very telling. So If you want to learn a little bit more about how your community is kind of classified, or what the metrics are that people are using to classify and score, take a look at the AARP Livability Index. Once again, a free website that you can just plug in an address, a city, or a county. The concept of complete streets is also something that is important here. AARP in particular is a big advocate for complete streets and understanding how that can lead to aging in place, as well as in general community livability. So complete streets are really meant to be for everyone, no matter how they travel or who they are. Policies ensure that you've got a right-of-way plan designed and constructed that's safe for as many users or all users as possible. There are some people who are looking at Vision Zero as a complementary set of policies. Vision Zero is the idea that we should reduce traffic fatalities to zero in our communities and plan accordingly. Complete streets is a major part of that approach. But complete streets in general are better designed for older folks who are driving and walking. This is good for people no matter what mode of transportation that you're using. It helps you in staying active, independent, and involved in communities. So in the United States in 2011, there were a little over 32,000 traffic fatalities. More than 22,000 were people in cars, with about 4,500 people on foot, and just under 700 people on bicycles. And so complete streets, complete communities, and then also that accompanying Vision Zero set of policies is really aiming to bring these fatalities down as low as possible. And I want to talk, the last two points here are really about safety and driving and then kind of where we're going with some emerging technologies. So with respect to safety and driving, there are a number of potential challenges for older drivers that are important. And this is not age specific. People encounter some of these challenges at different ages in their life, some people even earlier before they would hit the age of 65, some people who might be in their 80s or 90s who are first experiencing these. But stiff joints and muscles, vision changes, hearing changes, cognitive impairment, slower reaction time and reflexes, and medications. And that last piece could actually apply to just about anybody and everybody. So with respect to families and older drivers, this is a difficult conversation to have. But I'd actually steer you over to an incredible resource that was done by the Hartford. It's about safe driving for a lifetime. It's a U.S.-based publication about having conversations with people as they age, about assessing and addressing issues that may be emerging within an older driver. So families in particular, this really looks to families for self-assessing older drivers, looking at issues like personality, driving record, available transportation resources, the geographic proximity to services, and long-term family relationships. So their advice is to get the facts, observe the driver, to discuss concerns with the doctor, investigate alternatives, and to be supportive as much as possible. These are difficult conversations to have. So with my grandmother, the thing that we realized, the trigger point that actually got us thinking about this was when she told us that she had stopped driving on freeways, even though that was the fastest way to get from point A to point B. And at first we just thought, oh, well, you know, it's no problem, it's just fast-moving vehicles or she's not comfortable. But we started realizing that that was connected to a lot more. And that once we started asking the questions and kind of drilling a little bit deeper, we started to realize that there were a number of warning flags that actually made it a timely conversation to say, you know what, it may be time for you to sell your car and to start relying on both family as well as those community transportation services. So these are just a few behavioral warning signs. The list in the Hartford publication, I think there were 22 in total. So I just took the top 10, which were all really relevant. But these warning signs would include decreases in confidence, difficulty turning to see when they're backing up, riding the brake or excessive braking, being easily distracted when driving, having other drivers honk horns, incorrectly signaling, perhaps one way or the other, or turning your hazard lights on, parking inappropriately, hitting curbs, scrapes or dents in your car, mailbox or garage, increased agitation or irritation when driving, all warning signs that we might want to either start monitoring or start a conversation with the person who may be displaying these signs. So the last piece is a big one, actually. It's about emerging technologies. 20 years from now, our roads will be markedly different. We won't see things the same way that we see today in 2018. in 5 years' time, we're going to start seeing rapid changes in the way that people are moving around in our communities. So the time for getting clued in and starting to have conversations about emerging technologies is now. Now, some of these technologies are here. How many of you have an Uber or a Lyft or a rideshare app on your phone right now? Right. These are actually convenient ways to get around. They're actually cheaper ways to get around than what would be a taxi cab in some ways. There are some political alignments that some people have problems with certain, you know, groups, whether it's Uber or Lyft. But these things are really important. Even something as simple as an app to find the next transit ride that will get you to the destination that you need. This is all emerging technologies and things that we're going to see becoming more and more ubiquitous as we, as society kind of progresses. According to one researcher, Venicia Suarez, about 25% of Americans age 55 plus are actually providers to the sharing economy. Not users of, but providers to the sharing economy. Uber reported that 1 in 4 drivers was aged 50 and older. So this is not just about people who need rides, but people who are looking for supplemental income, who are looking to actually get a job, provide a service to the community in some ways. So one of the things that's a bit, I don't think people realize, is that there are more entrepreneurial activities that take place in the older adult population of people age 50 plus than there is in what the millennial kind of group would be. More entrepreneurial activities among older adults than there are among millennials. And so this is an example of how older people are taking advantage of a shared economy opportunity. So also in a 2015 study, about 70% of boomers said that they'd be willing to test drive an autonomous vehicle, and 31% noted their willingness to purchase a self-driving car in the future, or 38% said that if their health prevented them from driving, they'd consider purchasing one. Autonomous vehicles are rapidly being researched and coming into our communities. It may not be in the next 2 to 3 years that we see them on the road, but there are some communities who are already witnessing autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars. So it's the wave of the future, but the future is not too far off. I'm not going to profess to being an expert in this area at all, but I'd say that where we're going is exciting and terrifying in many ways. I can tell you myself that the most stressful part of my life every single day is sitting in traffic with my family. And I would welcome the opportunity to not be behind the wheel of a vehicle. How many of you have ever seen that old Disney cartoon with Goofy, who goes from being this cool, calm, collected guy to being this rage, road rage guy? I showed my wife this, and she said, "I think that's explaining a lot about your driving tendencies." Not that this is the point, but I think it's really important to understand that there are opportunities that are out there as far as a number of challenges. Like I said, this was a very quick overview of a lot of things that are going on. Say thank you. And I think we've got time for a couple questions, if there are questions.
All right. Thank you, Alan. Yes, we'll start with the commission.
All right.
Does anyone have a question they'd like to ask Alan? John?
Well, of course. Thank you again, Alan. Very, very good talk that you did here. A couple of things, though, I guess I just wanted to get into. A lot of times with our developments, I just have been carrying this around in my is these very large developments that we have going on, 400, 500 houses or units in an area. The transportation systems end up, because you got 400 houses. Mm-hmm. What is that? That's 400 more cars, or 800 more cars, generally, into a system that is not really designed to go and handle that. Mm-hmm. And could you speak to that a little bit? I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about.
So I'll start with saying that it's a contentious issue. This is a parking question. Yeah. And that parking is a very difficult kind of nut to crack. Right? So in particular, developments that are happening in more dense neighborhoods are being encouraged in some municipalities, and I'm not quite sure what the zoning codes and or policies are here in Vancouver and Clark County, But some of these developments are encouraging less parking options and for people to ride transit as that trade-off, right? We might be able to build out more units in exchange for parking, right, in many ways. There is incredible pushback from the community, especially existing neighborhoods, of saying you're changing the composition of you know, parking spots and the characteristics of our neighborhood in many ways. I'm not going to advocate for or against because I can see both sides of the equation. I can tell you, though, that I know change is inevitable, but that with older adults and people with disabilities, that there is a greater need for mobility options that would allow for a curb-to-curb or door-to-door service. So there have been some arguments made that older adults would have less cars per household, and some arguments that have been made to say actually older adults are more reliant on automobiles. So I don't have a good answer for you, but I can tell you that it is a set of trade-offs that each municipality has to deal with in a way that doesn't have a perfect answer in some ways. I live in a community that's a denser community. I live in a townhome, and we have one home that's there that used to be an apple orchard, and people loved it. And then we moved in, and they said, where'd our apple orchard go? Plus, we've got a 2.5-story house here and less parking for us. So, I wish I had a good answer for you, but I can tell you that it's a tough one. It really is, especially in neighborhoods where people value their automobiles and value their on-street parking options.
It's a whole changing very rapidly. I mean, you said, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years or so, how things are going to change with transportation. And I think that's going to be one of the major pieces that's going to happen, you know, because we are so hooked on that car, you know, having that, see that, you know. And I've seen in Portland, and you know, how that has changed so much, where even National and other car rentals move into a community to offer them the opportunity to go and have, you know, a car for the weekend or whatever, you know. And so I see those kind of things kind of starting to happen a little bit, but not over here, though.
You know, I think an interesting thing about autonomous vehicles, and I'd say that Clark County will be, pretty much developing on par with a lot of other communities with respect to autonomous vehicles. So it's the technology that they need to get right, and that it can be in most communities. But with autonomous vehicles, you're going to start to see different parking and kind of flow patterns. And so when you've got a vehicle that's on the road for most of the day going from one place to the next, it's actually not about having a fixed parking spot, but having a waiting area or having a queuing spot where they can kind of get to the next place. So it'll be a different set of parking challenges or mobility challenges for those autonomous vehicles.
Well, and I see that, you know, this quarter mile thing that you're talking about is right on, you know, and I think we can go and develop with that in mind. That's going to help us out a little bit with our transportation needs and everything. You know, maybe having more parking lots, you know, those kind of things to be able to get to transit, whatever, a little bit closer.
We're redeveloping some of those parking lots and finding ways to kind of allow for those autonomous or alternative vehicles to flow through those areas. I think that goes hand in hand with the kind of redevelopment of suburban areas in many ways. And there'll be a lot of people who push back and say that that's not desired in their community as well.
And just two more things. I'm really glad that you brought up the complete streets. Because I really feel that that's a very, very important component to where we need to be going and everything. And as you know, ADA is built into that whole system and everything with and so I think that's very, very important for us as part of that. And then your whole thing of the family and older drivers. I went through that with my mom, and you were absolutely right. That was probably one of the toughest things I had to do, was to gently get those keys away from her.
Yeah.
You know, and that took me about 5 years to be able to do that. So
Well, our American cultural values are really closely connected to the automobile, and our rugged Pacific Northwest nature has this individualism as well that's difficult to say, I'm going to be dependent on somebody else. So we may have it a little bit more difficult here in the Northwest.
Yeah. But thank you.
Anyone else?
Yes. Thank you. That was very comprehensive. I'm interested in the designing communities aspect as it relates to academia and the developers. How much interplay is there, and how can you impact it more? I'm starting to see stairs as an absolute threat to my existence.
Right.
And we need to rip, that's all part of the environment, if you will. So how, do you feel you are able to impact and interface?
Absolutely, although I would say that the academy doesn't always value that interface. In that, you know, things like promotion and tenure are more along the lines of grants and publications. But I found that I'm not a tenured professor, and so I live in this area where I am able to do work in areas that I find are incredibly important in the community. So I'd say that the bottom line is this concept of nothing about us without us, which is community members should be involved in those processes of designing communities in many ways. So I've been doing more and more work around design charrettes and community facilitation to try and bring people into the conversation to say, how do we dial in an environment that would actually work for the users of this environment? So as an advocate, it's actually better for me to not be advocating and to allow people who are actually in that community to be at the table having those conversations. So I'd say I'm going to put it back on you to get involved and to find ways into some of those conversations. And I'd say community design is a little easier because there are public processes that occur, but you can challenge your municipalities as well to say, not only when is something going to be developed, but when in the process of design and development is there opportunity for public input. So what happens sometimes in public design processes is that you say, oh, I've seen the design schematics. I don't like it. I want to push back, and they say, we've already completed the conceptual design phase. It's too late to make those changes, but how do you get people meaningfully involved at the right time in a design process? And let's just do away with stairs, period. There are reasons for stairs. I am not saying that tongue in cheek, but as a cyclist, as a parent pushing a stroller, stairs are my enemy now because I can't do those things with my kids or with my bike. And too often I see people artificially putting an obstacle in for no reason other than the aesthetic. Should I tell you? So yeah, go down 13th Avenue, right? I walked over here and take a look at the gray building that was developed in the last couple of years and come up with an answer on why whoever designed that building had these porches that allowed for you to walk out to the back and then a big concrete block that would stop you from getting onto that porch. They are the most skate-friendly porches I've ever seen. As a former skateboarder, I think that they're wonderful. But from a functional perspective, why were those things put there? They are only a barrier for somebody who might want to leave their back door and walk onto the street without going through a muddy backyard. So I don't mean to pick on the developer whoever did that, but I cannot come up with a reason on why that would have been done that way. It's not a step, but it's a barrier in some ways. Definitely not universally designed. Yeah. So I hope that answers the question, maybe challenges everybody to kind of get a little bit more involved in the public process.
Ellen, when last we had you here, it was for our study on housing. And when we had an architect talk to us, he spoke about the Japanese and their focus of the manufacturers on accessible bathrooms. And he showed us pictures of the Toto showroom and how they had done extensive studies and were producing products, especially for the aging population. Are any car manufacturers testing or looking at ways to make it easier for the aging population to drive safer so that possibly they could even get a break on their insurance if they bought a car that would adapt to their needs?
Well, Well, I don't have any research that I can talk about in my back pocket, but, you know, I just from watching commercials on television, I can tell you, like, lane assist technology is one of those things that seems to be really great. Cameras, 360 cameras, and knowing kind of where you can turn, drive, back up, all of those things are really, really important. We bought a minivan recently because we've got two kids now, and one of the things that I realized is that Dodge and Chrysler were basically making accessible vans, and there was an option that was there for people who might need a modified van or a modified kind of vehicle in some ways. I think autonomous vehicles hold some promise, although I don't want to put all my eggs in that basket, but I think that there may be some mobility opportunities. And the other thing is, we've been talking to some folks around transportation and technology, autonomous vehicles in particular, that it's important to not say autonomous vehicles will help older adults because it will help them meet their needs, right? It will help them get from their home to you know, a medical appointment or just that need-based approach. That really the opportunity here is to engage what is a naturally growing resource in our community, which is older adults. There are dwindling natural resources in just about every corner we look at, right? Water and gas and clean air. But the aging population is a growing natural resource, and connecting people and allowing more mobility or better mobility is actually an opportunity if we look at it that way. And when we were talking to the planners in Portland about that, it's the first time they had thought about that. Oh, right, we could enhance community by getting older people to places where they could contribute, not just where they need services in some way. So it's a small tweak in the way that you look at things, but I think that it kind of lends itself to the positive aspects of aging. And we live in a, you know, an ageist society, that it's really important sometimes to look beyond that need-based or that deficit-based model toward that opportunity.
Thank you, Alan. No other questions from the commission. We would like to take the opportunity to see if we have questions. And there is a mic for you to come up and speak.
Hi. I have two questions, actually. The first is, given what you said about how difficult it is to have those conversations with an older relative that you're concerned about their driving,
right.
I wonder what your thoughts are on having the government or the licensing department set it up so that you reach 75 or 80 and you have to be retested.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting challenge, I'd say. Australia is a good model that's out there in that they have people go in for preliminary testing in higher frequencies at certain ages. So I don't know how long you go between licenses here in Washington. Is it 5 or 8 years? But it may.
I only moved here last year, so I'm not actually sure myself.
Yeah. So it may be that you've got some preliminary screening that would basically maybe be there for everybody. But if you didn't pass that, you would have a more robust set of screenings that you would need to go to make sure that you were getting licensed and being safe on the road. I think it's important for government and licensing departments, DMVs, to look at that as a safety issue, especially as we really aim for this idea of zero traffic fatalities. My sister herself got in an accident when she was 16. Nobody else involved in the accident whatsoever, but it changed her life. It had nothing to do with her physical or cognitive abilities, but it goes to show that even an individual can hurt themselves and can hurt damaged property, and so there's incentive for looking at that from the government lens.
And then my second question might actually be more for the commission. When we were looking at buying a home here, walkability was one of our most important things, and we were really disappointed that even a lot of the new developments that are still in progress, none of them have sidewalks. And even if they did, there's nowhere to walk to. They don't seem to be anywhere near even a corner store, let alone a library or the school or anything else. And I guess I'm wondering what the next steps are to actually making that a requirement or part of the conversation.
I would recommend that whatever community you're interested to
Well, we ended up buying in Rose Village, and we're very happy there.
Oh, okay.
We found the type of community we were looking
City for. City and county planning commissions, your other local officials, city council, those, or planning staff, those would all be areas to start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Very well.
I have one question. You mentioned 40% of adults, older adults nationwide living in areas without, rural areas without good access or any access to public transit, and that being something that needs national attention. Is it getting that national attention?
No, I'd say that it's, well, it's a conversation that has kind of emerged in certain circles. I wouldn't say that at the federal level we're talking about that type of issue. There are national nonprofits and funders like the Grantmakers and Aging that are looking at these issues nationally and trying to kind of coordinate. There's a rural aging kind of listserv that you can, that anybody can jump on. Mm-hmm. That's Grantmakers and Aging. I think you could probably just do a Google search for rural aging GIA or Grantmakers and Aging. And people post on that kind of some issues. Just today there was a question about what some of the pressing issues of rural aging were to get people thinking about certain things. But no, I wouldn't say that, for instance, like our, you know, highway safeties and or national level kind of infrastructure conversation is really looking at rural aging in a number of ways. The other thing that's really important is that a lot of this ends up falling to AAAs that are in rural AAAs, or Area Agencies on Aging, which are direct benefits of older American Act dollars. And they're overwhelmed with the types of things that they're needing to deal with. You know, not just transportation issues, but issues like how do you find gatekeepers that can look to make sure that somebody's safe, that there aren't issues with mental behavioral health, that there aren't, you know, problems with drug and alcohol addiction, things along those lines. And in rural communities in particular, because there's the opportunity for isolation, that it's a very complicated set of issues mm-hmm. that are out there. The gatekeepers could be like a postman or a police officer who are trained to look for certain things. But the work that I at least am kind of aware of that's happening in rural transportation is more on the nonprofit and or funded through government programs, but supplementary to systems. It's just very difficult to make it, you know, to make it cost effective to provide Absolutely. Transportation services in rural and remote areas, especially those kind of far-flung remote areas that are very far out there. And I actually don't see a lot of movement on this happening in the next few years. Infrastructure will see more attention, but that's not really going to change the transportation funding, which is probably due for a cut here in a year or two. Sorry, there's not better.
Helen, I want to tell you about the City of Vancouver's app. Since you talked about the app for Uber and Lyft, the City of Vancouver has their own app where you can send to them areas that need repair.
Oh, so right.
Sidewalks, potholes, any of that. Yeah. And I think that all of us realize that if we get those kinds of improvements, it'll be from local government.
Yeah.
And I also want to recommend AARP's online driving course for seniors.
Yeah.
I took that.
Oh, great.
One of the first things I learned is the problem with senior drivers is not that they drive too fast, but they might be driving too slow. So you have to speed up and stay with the flow.
Is that called the 55 Alive still?
Sorry?
Is the AARP program still called 55 Alive? Yeah. It's a good program. I should have mentioned that here as well, but it's a good place to kind of get started to get educated about these things.
It was very good, and when I signed up for it, I saw that it would take 8 hours online, and I thought, oh, I can probably blow through that in an hour. No.
Yeah.
They tell you. They show you. They repeat it. Mm. You get it.
That's good to know.
And then you get a reduction in your insurance.
Oh, right. But you have to be 55, right?
No, I don't think so. How are they going to check? Oh,
insurance
maybe because
company.
Of your membership. I think you get that at 50, though.
45, actually.
45.
Yeah, AARP, you can join at 45 now. I'm 5.5 years away.
Very good.
Okay. Marianne, one thing.
Oh, Chuck, I didn't even see you over there.
for the young lady, you know, that's the reason why we are having this discussion this year. The whole issue of walkability in our neighborhoods, not only the new neighborhoods with connectivity to transportation and everything is an issue, but also the walkability in our older neighborhoods where we have very few sidewalks put in, you know, and they have really a difficult time being able to access to transportation without doing what Alan was saying, getting out in the road and all of that. So that's the reason why we're having this whole discussion this year is just that. So thank you for being here.
And thank you all for having me here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, call your attention to, again, the new business updates and announcements on our agenda, and remind you that the Clark County Human Services Transportation Plan community meeting will be in this room and will also be televised March 20th. Note the date. And that next month we will be having our meeting April 17th for alternatives to driving, and we will have the celebrity Sean Donaghy, the new executive director for CTRAN, and I have it on good source from the mayor that Sean is a rock star. So thank you all. We're adjourned.